ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, and welcome to this summer edition of Country Breakfast. I'm David Claughton. It's a great time of year to be relaxing on a holiday or reading a book, lazing in bed on a quiet morning. If you're in a reflective mood, then today's show will suit you very well. We'll look back at some of the best stories we've run over the last year, including the former chef in Tasmania who decided to become a farmer instead and established his own organic market garden.
I love growing up on a farm. Small-scale farming especially appealed, just make it a bit more, I suppose, flexible and approachable. Trying to figure out, I guess, a way of farming that could make for a healthy lifestyle too.
It hasn't been without its challenges, but more on that later. First, Michael Condon has been looking into the archives of the ABC's iconic agriculture and mining program, The Country Hour. The program marked its 80th anniversary in 2025, and he's been looking at some of the key stories over that time, including the long-running debate surrounding genetically modified food.
Hello, everyone. This is Dick Sneddon of The Country Hour with a program for the farm families of Australia.
Since the 1990s, there's been fierce debate among the Australian political and scientific and farming communities about the benefits or otherwise of GM crops. Genetically modified crops in Australia are primarily grown for their agronomic benefits, including pest resistance and herbicide tolerance. The main GM crops cultivated now commercially are canola, cotton and safflower. GM cotton was introduced in 1996. It's significantly reduced pesticide use and is widely adopted across New South Wales and Queensland. GM canola was approved in 2003. For years, there's been a fierce debate about whether GM crops pose a risk to human health in the food chain or to the environment. These crops are overseen by the Office of the Gene Technology Regulator. While other GM food crops, such as wheat and bananas, are undergoing field trials, public acceptance and regulatory oversight, continue to closely watch the future of biotechnology advancement in Australian agriculture.
Tomatoes in America tasted lousy. They were crummy. It was sort of like the Holy Grail. You mean you can make a good-tasting tomato? Well, wow, that's great.
The idea behind it was that we were going to have tomatoes that weren't going to ripen as fast. And so they would have a better storage life or shelf life after the consumers brought them at their supermarket.
The Flavor Saver tomato was the first genetically engineered food approved anywhere in the world. Several hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people ate them before the flaws in the business plan, shall I say, overcame us.
We believed the future lay in biotechnology and agriculture. Up until then, agriculture had progressed through really hybridization of plants. You crossed the genes of two similar plants and that gave you an incremental increase and you sort of went up the line with that. This was revolutionary in its scope, not evolutionary. Well, it was in part evolutionary, but it was a major evolutionary thrust.
Here we've got soybean plants that are growing. So with these growth chambers, we're able to duplicate any growing condition in the world.
We were helping the world decrease its use of pesticides. We were making plants safe from the principal disease or insect that attacked the plant. We were allowing the plant then to be resistant to Roundup. We gave people a better product. We caused less work on their part. And we sold our own seeds and our own Roundup. It was a great, you know, it was a synergistic effort, let's put it that way.
We were told by a government advisory committee in 1990 that eating beef burgers was perfectly safe. 5-6 years later, the scientists discovered that that was not so. And I think there has been a complete loss of confidence, loss of faith, loss of credibility in the establishment, in politicians, in officials, that when they say food is safe, I think most people's view is, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? And people don't want to take the risk. But what do I think is going to happen? I think the industry will continue to press the case, but until people's attitudes change in this country, there is no market for it.
We have spent the last 15 years building up a fantastic perception by overseas consumers and users of our produce that we're a clean, green producer. And I don't see it's economically sensible to put all that at risk with one introduction of canola. And regularly, my group that exports a range of different Australian products and produce gets requests these days asking for us to confirm that the product we're supplying is from non-GM. And I don't want to be in a position to be unable to sign those requests saying we are not a GM producer.
We've been able to achieve about a 50% reduction in pesticide requirement on cotton as a result of BT cotton technology. And with two-gene cotton, that reduction will be even more dramatic. In fact, probably around 80% reduction compared to conventional cotton. So growers are certainly saving a lot in pesticide costs. But I think the argument that's more important is that the environment has been benefiting right from the start with much reduced use of pesticide.
I'm disgusted and I have no confidence at all in this decision. We will be branded as GM and the markets are tightening. We will get contamination. It is irreversible. It should not be imposed on those that don't want anything to do with the crop.
I think this is crass populism. I think it is bad politics and I think it's bad policy. I have an understanding of the motivation behind it. There'll be far more voters out there that would disagree with me than would agree with you. I would like, over a period of years, to change their minds.
And I got a call on my cell phone in which informed me that my beans had tested 1.37% genetically modified. And so that shot that contract and ended up costing us roughly, you know, $10,000 U.S. money. And I was surrounded basically by the Roundup Ready system being grown by neighbors on 11 different border fields. You could sue your neighbors or whatever, but how do you know which neighbor you're going to sue? And it's really kind of nuts starting to sue neighbors over this sort of thing. So
we would have to be spraying probably two and sometimes three different herbicides to control the weeds that we can now spray with one application of Roundup or Liberty. The Canola Council of Canada did a survey in year 2000 because the transgenic growers are using less herbicides per acre. There was actually a saving of 6,000 tons of herbicide that did not have to be used on our canola crop that year. So that environmentally, that I think is quite a saving to the environment.
My position I could term gently, gently genetics. I think that this is a series of techniques of huge, huge promise. Therefore, why should we go gently? We should go gently because society has a great fear of what I term conjectural hazards, hazards that are theoretical, that I doubt whether have any real reality. And therefore I'd like the research to progress that this controversy will quietly go away.
Native title refers to the legal recognition of Indigenous Australians' traditional rights to land and waters based on their customs and laws. This concept was formally acknowledged in 1992 through the landmark High Court decision of Mabo, which overturned the doctrine of terra nullius, the idea that Australia was unoccupied prior to British colonisation. Since this High Court decision, farmers and graziers have been worried the secure title of farmland and pastoral leases could be under threat from native title.
Speaker, with this decision, one more barrier, historically perhaps the greatest barrier, has been effectively removed, and the foundations of discrimination and prejudice kicked away.
This is PM, I'm Ellen Fanning, and first up tonight, Paul Keating has used parliamentary question time today to reassure farmers, miners and state leaders about his plans for native title.
With the National Farmers Federation Executive Director, Rick Farley, saying the government could no longer be trusted.
If you look at the record, the Prime Minister and the government have made three clear promises. The first, that they will restore certainty to native title. If we're in court, that's broken.
Secondly, this is a concerted campaign by the Leader of the Opposition to cause fear and loathing, hatred and division in the rural sector of this country.
NFF voted to support the original bill on the basis that we believed that it adequately protected the interests of farmers and pastoralists, and included in that legislation was the requirement that if there was ever a conflict between the rights of existing landholders and the rights of native title holders, then the rights of the landholder would prevail.
Doctrine of terra nullius
which said that this country was desert and unoccupied when Europeans came here, is to be rejected and relegated to the dustbin of history.
ABC National News with Glenn Moore. In a landmark native title judgment, the High Court has ruled that pastoral leases do not extinguish the rights of traditional landowners. The court has found that the two can coexist.
It is, to me, an historic moment because for the first time, I'm here all the way from Cape York, and I'm proud to be a Sawik woman.
What it means for the rest of us is that native title will be presumed to exist everywhere. And the onus is going to be on leaseholders everywhere, whether they're in the far north of Queensland, Victoria, or even in the city of Canberra.
Working the land is tough enough. The High Court's weak decision has made it even tougher. Whose land is it? Who can use it? Farmers want their rights restored and control of their future. The weak decision. Tell the politicians we need legislation to sort out the mess and get it right. For the sake of black and white.
It's playing up all the deep-seated fears of white Australians going way back, and we feel that's very unhelpful.
No, we won't withdraw the advertisements, and we don't believe that it's racist or divisive. What we're trying to do is raise the issue in the...
Don McGauchie and the National Farmers Federation have pursued this putrid public campaign of disinformation, and there is no way that we're going to stomach sitting across a table with people like that.
For the sake of black and white.
The former National Farmers Federation Chief Executive Rick Farley explained it was eventually determined that native title can coexist with other land interests such as pastoral leases and varies in scope depending on the nature of the claim. It doesn't grant ownership in the Western legal sense but affirms rights to access and manage land according to Indigenous traditions. Rick Farley.
There were traditional owners who were coming up to pastoralists saying, well, you know, we're going to have your property. And equally, there were politicians and others running around saying your backyard's at risk, freehold's at risk, and so on. Now, that was never the case. Freehold clearly extinguished native title. And the Wick judgment, even the Wick judgment, confirmed the position that if there was a conflict between the rights of existing landholders and the rights of native title holders, then the rights of the landholder prevailed. So I could never see the basis for the fear campaign that was run.
Prime Minister John Howard and his deputy, Tim Fischer, ventured deep into enemy territory over the weekend when they met with over 2,000 angry pastoralists in the Western Queensland city of Longreach.
You can't be put off your property. You can't be stopped from carrying on your pastoral activities on your property. Your right to do that will be fully confirmed.
You could only describe John Howard's performance as very convincing as he began the hard sell to a crowd who were clearly calling for blanket extinguishment of Aboriginal rights on leasehold land.
I'm asking for your support for and your understanding for amendments that will address the very problems that you've raised. I know the anger, I know the feeling.
I worry about the basic rights of being able to put food on the table, a roof over their heads and provide some form of education for my children. Will you guarantee a future for the Australian rural families? Will you guarantee a security of tenure?
Please don't believe this fear-mongering that says native title claimants can throw you off your property. They can't. We will never, ever allow that to happen.
To my knowledge, there's been very little changes in management that have been necessary. I mean, if you look at the facts, that there's much greater potential for cultural heritage legislation to impact on landholders than native title. Cultural heritage, Aboriginal cultural heritage, is protected under both Commonwealth and state legislation and across all tenures, irrespective of whether it's freehold or perpetual leases or whatever. But we've had nowhere near the same degree of hysteria about protection of cultural heritage as we had about native title. By far the biggest impact of native title has been on the mining industry. There's really no advantage, in my view, to going to court. If you can reach an agreement as the first option, then you don't have to hand the decision over to a judge or to a politician. So I've always taken the position that there is no downside to looking to agreements as the first option. And if that fails, I guess you can always come back to the court system. But the mining industry is now taking the approach of reaching agreements with Aboriginal people based on the need for long-term relationships. It certainly hasn't delivered as much as the initial expectations might have been. I think the real value of the Mabo decision has been to put Aboriginal people at the negotiating table where there is something on their country that other people want. So if you've got minerals, if you've got gas, if there's something on a community's traditional country that other people want, then there's a capacity to negotiate about how those resources might be developed. However, if you haven't got anything on your country that white fellas want, you're still stuffed, in my view. I think it is important, though, to keep an historical perspective about all of this. It's only in 1967, for instance, that Aboriginal people legally were distinguished for the first time from fauna and flora in our legal system under the common law. In that time, there have been some very significant advances, one of which is Mabo. I mean, really what the court found in Mabo is that there's a surviving system of Indigenous property rights.
For well over 100 years, rabbits have been the scourge of farmers and graziers eating out precious pasture or grass previously designed to feed cattle or sheep. The damage wrought by rabbits ran into billions of dollars, turning some properties into dust bowls. Trapping and shooting didn't work. So since the 1950s, biological control seemed to be the only solution. The introduction of the myxoma virus in the 1950s and the rabbit hemorrhagic disease, or Khaleesi virus, released in the 1990s, both drastically reduced rabbit populations. However, resistance has developed over time, necessitating ongoing research into new biocontrol measures. The country has been reporting on rabbit control since its inception in the 1940s. Invasive species expert Tony Peacock explains.
They were probably the fastest feral ever that's ever been documented. They were released in one small spot in Geelong in 1859, and by 1910 they were probably completely over the country. They're still spreading right up into the Atherton Tablelands now. We're finding them in places we never thought rabbits would get to.
But they weren't just spreading by themselves, for a few people soon realised there was big money to be made from selling rabbit meat and fur. And so drovers and trappers carried pairs of rabbits with them, letting them go in areas well ahead of the spreading population. In parts of New South Wales, the impact was becoming serious. Plagues of rabbits stripped the ground of all cover. Very soon, much of the best pastoral country looked like a huge rabbit warren. The economic effect was alarming, and sheep numbers fell to half their previous level.
Rabbits still cause the biggest economic impact of well over $200 million a year of impact to agriculture. They have altered the landscape immeasurably, and people don't realise that we actually have two pulses of vegetation in outback Australia. One in the 1950s, when the trees were able to get away from the rabbits during the relief given by myxomatosis, and then again in the 1990s with relief from Khaleesi virus. But now we're starting to see that vegetation back off. Now, can you imagine with our sparse vegetation through the outback of Australia if we didn't have that vegetation? You know, dust storms, tourism, all the things that would flow from that. You know, in the 1940s and 50s, they had to dig out railways all the time through that part of the world because, you know, they just had to shift the sand off there, and we just don't realise these days. And indeed, through the Depression, rabbits were a major source of protein in the Australian diet. Many families lived off rabbit. And
underground mutton.
And even to this day, those people that lived on it constantly sort of shudder at the thought of rabbit again, another rabbit meal. But that doesn't get away from the fact that all that time they were doing massive agricultural and environmental damage.
Then in 1898 came news from South America. In Montevideo, Professor Sanarelli of the Hygiene Institute discovered a virus which was killing the domesticated rabbits he was using in his experiments. A few years later, Dr. Arageo, working in Brazil, suggested to the Australian government that this myxoma virus could be used for rabbit control. But the idea of introducing such a disease into Australia created a lot of opposition at the time, and so the proposal was shelved.
My understanding was that the fellas went out from CSIRO Wildlife and Ecology and they inoculated rabbits all over the place, I think towards Mildura, and nothing happened. And they came home for Christmas as a result. They thought they might as well come home for Christmas. And then there was a telegraph early in January saying, come out again, major deaths of rabbits all over the place, or something to that effect. And so they rushed back out there and the pandemic had sort of taken effect.
Crops and pastures grew in a way that hadn't been seen for years, and the national income rose dramatically.
Over time, the virus became less effective and new strains were introduced. But myxomatosis still kills probably 40% of the rabbits born in the country today at no cost.
Proudly we stand in love to serve, filling the needs of others where they lie.
I think that one of the outstanding reasons for the spread of CWA was the craving of the women for companionship and company, and the feeling that they weren't right out of the swim of things. And I've always felt that the CWA did more to reconcile women to the loneliness of the outback than anything else that could have been dreamed up.
Membership is open to all women who are loyal to the throne and willing to give service to our community. Every meeting opens with the national anthem. Through country women, for country women, by country women.
And really, I think people have forgotten the enormous amount of practical work.
There were three of us girls and we had to lift bags of chicory, and I also went on a potato digger, and we had to work in the carrots, dig out carrots and dehydrate them for the troops. And I also worked with prisoners of war in the dehydrator.
Rural women are often the backbone of farming enterprises. They contribute not only to the hands-on agricultural work, but also in leadership, education, health and community development. Their involvement spans from managing farms and agribusinesses to pioneering food science, environmental stewardship and digital technologies in agriculture. Despite historical underrepresentation, women were only legally recognised as farmers in 1994. Their influence has grown steadily, with now many leading industry bodies and advocacy groups such as the CWA. Increasingly, the country has sought to empower rural women.
In those days, girls were expected to be teachers or nurses, and girls were not seen to be farmers.
And in fact, you became a nurse, didn't you?
Yes, I became a nurse.
Now, while you trained as a nurse, you eventually made that transition, though, didn't you? You became a farmer in the end. How did that occur?
By becoming a farmer's wife. We weren't in the community as farmers. We were in the community as homemakers. I took over the family farm after the death of my husband. And one of the most exasperating things that used to happen to me was I would have agents coming to the door or ringing me up and saying to me, is the boss at home? And when I said yes, what could I do for you? You could see these people, and they were mostly men, being really uncomfortable having to deal with a woman. And over the past few years, I've heard lots of women have shared the same experience.
Even with people who know the amount of work I do and have seen me doing it, they still find it very difficult to accept me as a farmer. But I've had a lot of trouble in the past with people like stock agents, people in machinery shops. The image of the farmer in the media is still the same, unfortunately. You have shows like the ABC Country Hour, which constantly refers to farmers as he.
It's interesting because when we started saying that women farm, it was a hell of a challenge to this community and any other rural community, because tradition has it that farmer is male. people felt that we were trying to take over, because people were frightened of the women's movement, and they were certainly frightened by the word feminism, and they thought we were trying to take over, not realising that we see ourselves as partners and we devote our lives to working with our partners for our family. We just wanted to be recognised.
Hello, I'm Lucy Broad, and welcome to this special broadcast celebrating the first ever International Women in Agriculture Conference being held in Melbourne this weekend, and the awarding of ABC Radio's inaugural Australian Rural Woman of the Year Award to South Australian farmer Deborah Teely.
It gives me tremendous pleasure to accept this award on behalf of all rural women. As I have said previously, the awards at state and national level have had a great impact for rural women, as has the conference, and I can see us all going from strength to strength.
Oh, it was just amazingly important, because it actually raised the profile in the public sphere. People could see it was an extremely successful conference. It was one of the largest ones, or the largest agricultural farming conference held in Australia at that time. Now, not only were we there saying that we were farmers, but the contest actually identified a number of particularly good women farmers. So we're saying we're there, but the proof of the pudding was there were women who were extremely good farmers who were part of that contest.
Inside the farm gate, they work equal with their partner, make the decisions together, all the financial decisions, and yet beyond the farm gate, you don't see the women at all making policy decisions or financial decisions to do with the commodity groups. I think it's just disgraceful that in 1994, when women put so much into Australian agriculture, put so much into the export dollar, that we have been ignored.
And that completes another session of the Country Hour. So until tomorrow, cheerio.
Thanks to Michael Condon for that special on the major stories covered by the Country Hour over the last 80 years, Australia's longest running radio program. You can listen to the whole program by searching online for the Country Hour 80th documentary by Michael Condon. Still to come on this summer edition of Country Breakfast, we look back at some of the best stories from across the year. We'll hear from a veteran postie who's been delivering parcels and letters to outback stations for nearly three decades, driving thousands of kilometres each week to provide an important lifeline for remote residents.
Well, I'm the only one they see from one week to the next.
Mm.
And a lot of times I turn up and they'll say, oh, shit, is it mail day? They forget when they're in the bush.
You'll hear more from Ruby Gamble about her life as an outback postie.
If you woke up tomorrow and found yourself Prime Minister, what would you do? How would you run Australia? What's your plan for energy, for housing, for the economy? The Economy Stupid has a three-part series talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it where you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to Country Breakfast. I'm David Claughton. This week, we're looking back on some of our favourite stories from 2025, visiting special places and hearing from interesting characters in regional Australia. We'll hear from a veteran postie who's been delivering parcels and letters to remote outback stations for nearly three decades, driving thousands of kilometres each week to provide an important lifeline for remote residents. We'll be tasting homegrown coffee in North Queensland. And while Australian baristas have a reputation for making a great cup of coffee, the same can't be said for locally grown coffee beans. But we'll hear from farmers hoping to change that. And we'll also head to Tassie, where a former chef has taken a career turn into horticulture, establishing an organic market garden. But he's having to share his produce with some other hungry mouths.
The possums and the cabbage moths really give me a run for my money. The possums especially don't seem to mind
My electric fence is surprisingly strong, but a brush-tailed possum must be surprisingly hungry too. So I'd have to deal with a lot of them. They can get through the carrots and anything they put their mind to, really. So yeah, I try to keep things covered as best I can and hope that they don't lift the nets and just go for it.
We'll meet that chef turned farmer. That's coming up. First today, we're heading to Victoria's East Gippsland, where years after devastating bushfires, native vegetation is growing back and birds are returning. Citizen scientists have been recruited to survey bird numbers in the region, and as Jessica Schremer reports, they're not just providing important data, but also benefiting their own mental health.
In Victoria's Far East, a group of volunteers is embarking on a trip to observe bird life along local waterways. Avid birdwatcher and boat operator Dale Winwood says it's been a slow recovery for the environment in this area around the remote coastal town of Mallacoota since devastating bushfires 5 years ago.
We used to get woken up by birds every morning. Like there was a cacophony of birds every morning used to wake you up. And after the fires, it just went dead silent. It was really eerie and it was strange. There was no birds, no nothing. So we're starting to get the birds back in the gardens around town now, and it's starting to pick up. I don't think the birds will be back to the numbers they were in my lifetime, but as the bush is coming back, we've had record rainfall, you know, record regen in the bush, and we're getting birds that are coming back with that, so it's encouraging.
Hello, I'm Jessica Schremer, and I'm chatting to some of the volunteers helping to survey birds in this region. For Leonie Dawes, it's a way of life to monitor the natural environment around her. She's been contributing to research tracking the recovery of the glossy black cockatoos. And 4 years after the fires, their natural food source is flowering again for the first time.
It's one which is really important in this area. It's the black she-oak or the casuarina. And it's important because the glossy black cockatoos, their territory extends down to just this part of eastern Victoria, and it's their only food source. They live on the cones from the seeds from the cones of the casuarina, and a lot of their habitat, the casuarinas, were burnt. And so one of the main focus of the work of BirdLife Australia since the bushfires has been to try to see how many of the glossies actually survived, locate where there are still casuarinas that have cones on them, and do what they can to actually build up the resources.
Besides assisting BirdLife conservation efforts, research studies identified birdwatching can reduce psychological distress and increase mental well-being. Mallacoota General Practitioner Dr. Crystal Souza sees the benefits in her patients firsthand.
The impact that birdwatching has on mental health and you know, on people who are able to connect with nature is very clear, and it's very positive. Particularly as a GP working with this population out in Mallacoota, you can really see the difference. People are more active, they're more likely to actively seek out, you know, birds and other parts of wildlife that they can't get just from home. And that keeps them healthier and happier, really. You see a very positive relationship between mental health and nature.
From birdsong reducing stress to observations aimed at protecting bird life, Dr. Souza says the human-nature relationship is a true win-win situation.
The connection between, you know, the positive mental health outcomes and, you know, the actual participation in citizen science, so that is recording and making notes of where and what birds you've seen, have a really great impact on conservation, because it shows that you as a single person can actually have a role in helping conservation. It allows you to interact with the data that you're seeing that's reported from the end of it, and overall just makes you understand that there is such an intricate link between how we impact nature, how nature in its pristine condition compared to its, you know, urbanized condition really can change, and it makes you want to do something about it. I think it motivates you in a better way, which is really great.
Aboard his boat, Mr. Winwood noticed it's people from all walks of life taking up bird watching.
Surprisingly, we're getting a lot of younger people these days. You know, some people you might walk past in the street, you know, sleeve tattoos and, you know, all the rest of it, and I'm seeing that a lot of people like that on board, and, you know, they're amazing birders. They could be 100 years old with the knowledge of birds, so it's amazing. Usually birders are like-minded, they like being outdoors and out and about, so and that's what it's about. It's about getting out, so it's good for the mind, it's good for the soul. If you wander off in the bush and go bird watching, you know, it's just good for you. You know, you're out and about and you're moving around, so bird watching is fantastic.
for dedicated Malacuta teachers like Ms. Dawes, it's about sharing ornithological knowledge with others while celebrating how the practice of birdwatching brings communities together.
Particularly in the area of birds, citizen science is really effective because lots of people can identify at least the key birds, and that makes it possible for more people to get engaged in the citizen science, and that spreads awareness amongst the families, amongst the communities where those people are located. It's just a really important part of life here, particularly because we have so much beautiful forest and heathland and various kinds of habitats that we can visit. I think just reflecting particularly on the period of COVID, that was immediately after the bushfire, and lots of people were really, really devastated by the burnt forest. But for us, the really healing part of it was to go out and see the signs of regrowth in the forest, the little bits of green coming out as the trees sprouted, the little bits of grass coming through, trying to identify the plants. We knew quite a few of the plants as adult plants, but trying to say, no, is that leaf actually going to be this kind of pea flower, or is it going to be something else? So there was almost a sense of excitement about watching the bush. There's so much to learn, so much to be impressed by, and just so much beauty.
A few things are certain in the outback around Cunnamulla. Dingoes don't want pats, the next drought is never far away, and Ruby Gamble, the outback postie, will make her deliveries. Now in her early 70s, Ruby has spent nearly three decades delivering mail, medicine, beer, and just about anything else her remote customers need. Her route takes her across the vast sun-baked roads around Cunnamulla in southwest Queensland.
Oh, it's 10,000 k's a month.
Your poor vehicle, what do you do it in?
Yeah, you trade it in every 4 years.
Ruby's postal truck making its way up the drive is a wonderful sight for people who live and work on isolated sheep and cattle stations the size of European countries.
Well, I'm the only one they see from 1 week to the next.
Mm.
And a lot of times I turn up and they'll say, oh, shit, is it mail day? Yeah. Oh, what day is it? Thursday or Friday? Oh, it's Tuesday. Oh, okay. They forget when they're in the bush.
That makes Ruby more than just a delivery driver. She's a lifeline. The postie even kept in touch when devastating floods across western Queensland earlier this year made it too dangerous to go bush, forcing her into one of the longest breaks of her 28-year career.
But I keep ringing them to make sure they're all okay. And if they need food or anything, I'm prepared.
Ruby and her late husband, Cole, took up the Australia Post delivery contract in 1997 and shared the run for more than a decade. Her last moments with her larrikin husband were on a family fishing trip.
Married for 43 years, then the old bastard handed his rifle in on the Paroo River, fishing. Goes and has a shower. We caught a heap of fish, drinks a six-pack, if not more, eats a chop and a sausage on the barbecue, and he was a gadget man. He rigged up the shower that we could have a shower under on the riverbank. He goes and has a shower. He comes in, into the caravan, towel around him. He throws the towel open. He says, anyhow, Ruby, I'm the only one that knows how to find all the good fish holes. I said, shut up, you skiting bastard, and get in here. The last words I ever spoke to him. Within 10 minutes, he'd had a massive heart attack.
Ruby took a break from work after Cole's death while friends filled in on the mail run. But before long, her customers came calling.
And after a couple of months, Ruby, we need you out here. And made me get out of bed and keep going.
14 years since Cole's death, and Ruby hasn't remarried despite encouragement from her kids.
And one says, Mum, you know, we were never meant to be on our own. And if you find somebody else that's okay with us. Well, I started to laugh. It's nothing to be laughed at, Mum. I said, you bastard, only been here 4 days. I can't put up with you fellas. How am I going to put up with anybody else?
Over her 28-year mail run, Ruby's built up a level of trust with locals that has to be seen to be believed.
Matey, I go up to Croyd Opal Mines and they give me their bank cards, the miners, to come into town Write the PIN number on a bit of paper for me. Kids away at school. There's no kids away now, but when they were away at boarding school, they couldn't get into town to put money in their accounts. They'd give it to me and I'd put it in their accounts at the bank.
But of an afternoon, odds on, you'll find her enjoying a beer at the old Billabong Hotel in town, ready to share a tale from the road.
I've had a real good life.
Like, if you walk up and down Main Street, how many times are you stopping to say hello to people?
You don't, because you can't get home.
Ruby Gamble, a postie providing a vital connection, delivering mail to people in the bush in southwest Queensland. She spoke to reporter Dan McRae in 2025. I'm David Claughton with you for Country Breakfast as we look back on some of our favourite stories from the past year. And still to come, the former chef who set up an organic market garden and realised he loves growing food more than cooking it. And Australia's coffee culture is world-renowned, but our homegrown beans haven't had the same reputation as those coming from the highlands of New Guinea or Brazil and Colombia. Farmers in Queensland's north are hoping Aussies will develop a taste for locally grown coffee, and they've already won over a Colombian coffee queue grader. Reporter Charlie McKillop sat down for a cuppa with Sergio Londono in Mariba, North Queensland, to taste a special batch of coffee.
With the flavor, we used to say that the coffee doesn't lie, okay? Because when you taste a cup of coffee, you will realize if the coffee is old or is fresh or if it has some defects. So in this case, what we are looking for is that you can find a sweetness, acidity, a good aftertaste, because sometimes there are some coffees that once you try it, you can feel that bitterness, not only in at the beginning in your mouth, also in the back of your tongue. This coffee is a coffee that is very easy to drink. It's like drinking wine, a good wine to a bad wine. Here with coffee, we try to find different kind of flavors to start to enjoy. This is a culture around a cup of coffee.
Well, I am salivating now at the opportunity of tasting this locally homegrown, Mariba-produced specialty coffee. And is there a special way to drink? And I don't see any spittoon, so I am allowed to swallow?
Yes, of course. Go ahead. Please go ahead and tell me.
I can definitely taste some sweetness. It does have a lingering flavour. Stays on the tongue. No bitterness. That's a very smooth cup of long black coffee.
And fruity, very fruity.
Notes of plum was the description, and by nature, by name, Plum Murat, I was here a decade ago when you were planting your first coffee bushels at Paddy's Green. How far have you come? What does this cup of coffee represent in terms of where you're at with this venture?
Yeah, it's been 10 years in the process, but when we initially started, there were some bad remarks with Australian coffee. It was regarded as probably the worst coffee people ever drink in the country, but no, we've progressed quite well, and particularly with Sergio on board this year, he's done a lot of trials with fermentation, other processes, and also we've also added additional machines to the processing plant whereby we can separate now our red cherry from the green cherry from the natural. Then we can get a true even flavour, particularly on the red cherry. You can then go to your purchaser and say, well, listen, we can guarantee you this coffee is unique because it's been separated and all you're drinking is the red cherry alone. There's no green cherry mixed in there whatsoever, and you should be getting the prime cup of coffee out of that red cherry. Absolutely.
The Cairns hinterland, it's got the altitude, it's got the soil and the water, it's got all the ingredients. Are you going to be able to turn around what you described at the outset as Australia having basically a bad name when it comes to coffee?
Yeah, I think we've gone to a point now we've succeeded in certain areas to prove that we can grow good coffee in Australia, and there's no doubt about that. I think we've proven that point.
And now, Sergio, being a native of Colombia, though, are you going to ever concede that Australia can match you Colombians on the world coffee stage?
Oh yeah, absolutely. With no doubt, what we are doing from this year is to produce a coffee with high standards, very high standards. Some consumers that have tried our coffee, they say that it's hard to believe that this coffee is produced here in Australia, because the different flavors and the different characteristics that we achieve with the coffee on the last harvest is something that is almost completely new. So absolutely, I mean, this area here in the Tablelands produce almost the 80% of the total of the coffee of the country. But what we want to do is to do something different. The coffee culture here in Australia is huge. I mean, in many other countries, we learn from Australia about the coffee trends, about the how the people like to drink the coffee. I think that we have enormous potential to start to create a new chapter in the Australian coffee consumption. What we have been tasting and what we have been trying over the last months, I can say that it really tastes like some of the best coffee that I have tried in Colombia. So yeah, with total confidence on what we are doing here, I can say that the coffee that we are drinking right now is a coffee that can surprise many people around the world. Even more now, when people doesn't believe in Australian coffee, to show to them this kind of quality of coffee will surprise many people.
It's close to town and it's just a lovely quiet spot. I've got 10 acres out here and 2 acres under cultivation at the moment, fenced off from the huge amount of pests that I have around here. Well, not necessarily pests, native wildlife, brush-tailed possums, etc. Got a little shed out here and water tanks and trying to be self-sufficient, I suppose.
These days, former chef Harry Chandler is spending his working days out of the kitchen and in the paddocks here at his farm at Bridge North in northern Tasmania's Tamar Valley.
When I finished chefing in town, I studied horticulture knowing that I wanted to start a market garden. And yeah, just everything came into place, really. All the pieces fell into place.
Hello, I'm Larissa Smith. And I'm chatting to Harry Chandler and taking a tour of his organic market garden. He grew up on a farm in South Australia and says returning to living on the land was something he always wanted to do.
Yeah, so I came off a cattle property and large-scale cropping property about 2 hours from Adelaide. I love growing up on a farm and I love so many aspects of farming, but I think small-scale farming especially appealed, just make it a bit more, I suppose, flexible and approachable. That large-scale stuff, it takes so much, I think, time and energy and infrastructure and things, and trying to figure out, I guess, a way of farming that could make for a healthy lifestyle too, which is what we're aiming for out here, a healthy lifestyle. And for my son and partner, my partner is from a farm too, and so we both wanted to bring our son up on a farm and have time for him too, and time to still enjoy our lives outside of farming, which is sometimes difficult for farmers, I think, to find time outside of work.
What have you got growing?
At the moment there's garlic, radicchio, large leaf spinach, turnips, silver beet, celery, parsley, spring onions, broccoli, rocket, carrots, kale, cabbage. Yeah, a few different radishes, daikon radish, and a few other little bits and pieces that have self-seeded, and just experimenting, you know, hope for the best and see how they go, really.
Now, some of these rows are covered with cloth. This is to protect them from the very hungry possums that live in the region.
Very much so, yeah. The possums and the cabbage moths really give me a run for my money. The possums especially don't seem to mind. My electric fence is surprisingly strong, but a brush-tailed possum must be surprisingly hungry too, so I'd have to deal with a lot of them. They can get through the carrots and anything they put their mind to, really. So yeah, I try to keep things covered as best I can and hope that they don't lift the nets and just go for it. But at the moment, they're pretty happy just chipping away at my carrots and I'll leave them at that for now.
Everything's planted with a no-dig approach.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes for a less intensive system, I think, no-dig, and a healthier system. When you're, I guess, building up on existing beds and soil, you're doing nothing but adding health to it, really. You know, you've still got the existing mycelium in the soil and the nutrients and things like that, and keeping the roots in the soil, especially is where a lot of the nutrients, I guess, are focused, and letting them break down naturally is just makes for a really healthy system and healthy soil, which is, I think, that one of the main aims on the farm is just having healthy soil full of life and nutrients, really. Yeah, makes for good veggies.
You've also got fruit trees around the perimeter of your farm too. The long-term goal is to sell both fruit and veg to restaurants and wholesalers?
Absolutely, yeah. That's the long-term goal. If the possums leave my fruit trees alone for a little while, something might come up. But yeah, eventually, I think I've got 10 or 15 different types of kind of fruit trees and olives and cherries and hazelnuts and things in it. It's quite experimental at the moment, just seeing what goes well in this microclimate, because it is quite a harsh microclimate just from the exposure to winds and quite heavy frost and cold. It's probably a couple of degrees colder than Launceston on average. And so, the frosts are quite heavy and hard. So some of the fruit trees have not minded it, obviously deciduous ones, but other fruit trees haven't been as keen, especially my citrus, which I experimented twice doing, which was, you know, I'm not going to try a third time, I think.
Tell me about your relationship with your buyers, the chefs that you work with. How did that come about? Because I imagine as a former chef, you'd have a lot of contacts in the industry and an idea of what they want on their menus.
Yeah. I mean, having a background in hospitality has been incredibly helpful, and still having friends who work in hospitality and has been helpful too. I think Launceston and perhaps Tasmania as a whole really lend themselves well to supporting local produce and local growers and things like that. I think there's a real focus on that, which is incredibly helpful as someone who wants to grow fruit and veg locally. Winters are my quiet time, so I'll take winters off, like at least the majority of the winter off, to plan the next season. And that's usually when I speak to wholesalers and chefs and things about what they're looking for in the following season, or giving them at least a list of what I'll be aiming to grow in those seasons, so they can either build a menu around that, or I can grow things that perhaps they find a bit harder to find. To an extent, I'm still very much on a learning curve. I think maybe that will be a permanent thing, that I'm always going to be learning, which I hope I am. But yeah, so it's just still something I'm working out, exactly how much to grow and what to grow. But it's one of those things that if someone wants something short term and it takes 200 days to grow, it's not necessarily going to be there short term. So it's always a test to kind of grow the right amount. And yeah, someone might want lots of it and you're surprised because, you know, you haven't grown much of it. It's, yeah, always a test.
Harry, you're part of the Sprout Producer Program to mentor small-scale farmers new to the industry. What do you hope to get out of that?
I think what I really wanted to get out of it was kind of networking and meeting other small-scale growers in Tasmania. It also goes back to, I think, in Tassie especially, the support for small-scale growers is there, and I think Sprout are really doing their part in supporting small-scale growers and developing that in Tassie really well. I'd like to fill this 2 acres eventually with beds and plants and things like that. I really love growing. I'm quite good at it, but perhaps the business side needs a bit of work. It's not always my forefront. I'd rather have my hands in the soil than on a computer. But I think, yeah, I'll have to develop those skills a little bit, or perhaps develop more enthusiasm for those kinds of things, the business side of things. Yeah.
Harry Chandler, a former chef who set up an organic market garden at Bridge North in northern Tasmania's Tamar Valley. He spoke to reporter Larissa Smith about his journey into food producing, and she caught up with him in early 2025. And that's Country Breakfast for this week. I'm David Claughton. Thanks to Matthew Sigley for technical production, Kath McLean for the last of the big country stories. Next year, she'll work on major national stories for our special rural and regional unit. As always, you can get more rural news on Landline, on ABC TV and on demand through the iView app. And you can download the ABC Listen app to find the Country Hour in your state. or territory, and search ABC Rural to find a lot of other stories about agriculture and mining. Next on Radio National, Saturday Extra with Nick Bryant.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.